It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. There seems to be two kinds of people in the U.S. today, those who want to argue and those who want to avoid arguments at all costs. That doesn't seem like a recipe for getting things resolved. Our next guest, though, thinks that argument, constructive argument, is the only way out of the political and cultural quagmire we find ourselves in. Eric Liu is the founder and CEO of Citizen University. He's also the executive director of the Aspen Institute Citizenship and American Identity Program. He served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton. And he is the author, most recently, of You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. Eric Liu, welcome to the program.
So glad to be with you, Carrie.
So arguing, you've spoken a lot about arguing. You had a seminar at the Aspen Institute about how to argue well. We have a negative perception around the word, though. Why should we argue?
Well, I think, the nature of our politics right now is that it's so polarized and so divided that people's natural instincts are to try to build bridges and find common ground. And I think that's really important. I think it's good. I applaud those who are trying to do that. But as I said in an article in The Atlantic right before the 2016 presidential election, there are often times where a rush to reconciliation can be a dangerous thing. American history teaches us that. And if you think about the period after Reconstruction, when Reconstruction was getting really difficult and challenging, and there was this sudden surge of sentiment in both the North and the South among white citizens to reconcile, to return to reunion and really bridge these differences. And what that meant was that they were sacrificing the fledgling struggles of the freed slaves to this idea of reunion. And, mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that we've got to remember is that American civic life is an argument, right? Inherently, it is an argument. It is a set of there are a set of core tensions in American civic life between, for instance, liberty and equality. We like to think of those words as motherhood and apple pie, interchangeable ideas. But if you actually think about it, those are perpetually in tension. If liberty prevails in our debates, then we end up sacrificing equality, and vice versa. There's another core tension in American life between a Hamiltonian view of strong central government and a Jeffersonian view of limited government. Anybody who's a fan of the musical Hamilton can tell you about that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a core argument in American life between the idea of, just think about our national motto, between the pluribus side of our national motto and the unum side, the idea of, we are focusing on and celebrating our diversity, or we are focusing on our unity, right? Again, these are perpetually in tension, color blindness versus color consciousness. A federalist approach to government versus an anti-federalist approach, if you go all the way back to before.
So this is baked into this how this country was set up. I wanted to go back, though, to when you were talking about Reconstruction, that there's a tendency, we have a tendency sometimes to just say, hey, go make up.
We'll just get along, right?
Yeah, yeah. When we're little, we're told, go make up with that person you just had a fight with. But you're arguing that reconciliation sometimes isn't the way to move forward, that constructive argument is. Talk to me about that.
Well, look, my view is that in American political life right now, there are deep, deep divides of worldview, philosophy, experience. We live in an age of profound, nearly unprecedented inequality. We live in an age where the social contract that we've had for 50, 60 years is unraveling. This is a time when we should be having fierce arguments and fierce debates about the role of the citizen and the role of government, about how what we owe each other in a changing society, about who is us. And that debate is not something we can just quickly skip past. And, my bottom line way of putting it often is that we don't necessarily need fewer arguments in American civic life. We just need less stupid ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean to be glib there. When I say less stupid, I mean several things. I think, number one, as I was alluding to, we need arguments that are more grounded in a sense of history so that we recognize that some of those core American tensions that I was describing before are perpetually replaying themselves. The fight over the Affordable Care Act, the fight over immigration, the fight over tax cuts, all of these are recapitulations of these old, old American arguments. And if we can see that, we can recognize that the point of American politics isn't to achieve, quote, total victory by one side over the other, but it's to remember that American political life is a game of perpetual, infinite repeat play. And we've got to try to figure out how to make our arguments, but also recognize that the point is you're going to win some, you're going to lose some, and you're going to have to split the difference sometimes, but not that you're going to wipe the other team off the face of the earth, which is increasingly the spirit of our politics right now. But the second thing I would say is that what makes a less stupid argument, what I call a better argument, is also one that is more attuned to the emotional dynamics underlying any argument, being more emotionally intelligent about what it means to engage with somebody. And I think one of the lessons that we've learned in the Better Arguments Project that I run out of the Aspen Institute is not so much about how you argue, but rather how you listen. Mm. Our politics right now is corroded not so much by people making claims and making arguments, but it's corroded by the fact that so many people have forgotten willfully how to listen, right? We listen with a certain, what I call, debater's ear. You listen only in as much as is needed to get the gist of what the other guy is saying so that you can prepare to demolish him, right? Rather than listening, in fact, to understand and, in fact, to kind of really see the world from the vantage point that this other person is expressing. And that habit of listening not to win but to understand is something that has fallen out of practice in American civic life, and we've got to rebuild it.
Eric Liu is talking to us about how to argue better. He runs the Better Arguments program out of the Aspen Institute. We would like to know if you're listening to this program right now and if you would like to call us and talk to us about arguing, about if you are afraid to confront people and argue with people. Maybe you just don't know how. You're kind of stuck in a situation when somebody says something that you disagree with and you don't really know what to say. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Eric Liu gives a lot of advice on how to argue better, and maybe he can help some of our listeners who have questions about that. I often will find myself flat-footed, Eric, when somebody says something that I fully disagree with or is perhaps non-factual. How do people respond in those situations?
Well, I think, again, one of the most important things we can do.
We seem to have lost him. Eric Liu, we're seeing that he's on the air, but we are getting some phone calls talking about the better way to argue. Eric Liu runs the Aspen Institute Better Arguments Center, and we are taking your calls. Do you avoid arguing at all cost? Do you have friends who disagree with you still, or have you gotten rid of those friends? Have you unfriended them if you are on social media with them, or have you just not stopped talking to them? Have you had people stop talking to you, and you don't quite know why? Because you have what you see as differences of opinions. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, ideas@wpr.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. One of the things that Eric Liu talks about is that arguing is endemic to our American system, to the founding of this country. And we can see that in Hamilton. We want to know if you think that's true and how we can get back to having better arguments, not just arguing for the sake of arguing. We're getting Eric Liu back on the phone, and we're going to go to break right now. It's the morning show.
Music.
It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We are talking with Eric Liu today. He's the executive director of the Aspen Institute, and he runs a program to help people argue better. But what exactly is better argument? Have you given up on having constructive arguments? Do you dread family get-togethers? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also, I'm going to say that slower, 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Eric Liu, you are back after the argument gods got us. I want to talk about what makes a bad argument?
It's a great question. I'm sorry. I'm not quite sure where I got cut off by the argument gods, but I will say that the point I was in the midst of making was just about listening. I just want to really underscore that.
Okay.
And you know, in answer to your question, what makes a bad argument? I think if you ask anybody that, they don't have to be sophisticated students of American history or American politics. Everybody has probably fairly recently had a bad argument,
mm-hmm.
and they will tell you, you know, the kinds of things that make an argument bad are number one, just a rapid rush to judgment. Number two, this sense that you begin to lose control emotionally, and it really stops becoming about the thing itself and more just about protecting your own sense of identity or even dignity. What also can make a bad argument is when people are just rehearsing talking points that they've heard somewhere else or been programmed to repeat instead of actually dealing with the human across from them, right? And I think people would also say that what makes a bad argument is when both parties are basically in a race to shirk responsibility, right? To blame the other and never take on their own piece of how we got into this fight or what we or what might be weak in their own worldview or position. It's what the great psychologist C. Terry Warner calls accuse to excuse, right? I accuse you in order to excuse me and let me off the hook. That's a common pattern in bad arguments. But again, most fundamentally, what makes a bad argument is when neither party is actually hearing the other or listening to the other. They're just in pure mutual assured destruction mode of I'm going to blast you with my best ammunition. And I think, again, our political culture right now both incentivizes that, it celebrates that, our TV culture rewards that. And so the spirit of our project, the Better Arguments Project, is a spirit that is very much grounded in place and in community, right? All across the state of Wisconsin right now, as people are listening, they're thinking not necessarily about life in Washington, D.C. or between the White House and the Congress. They're thinking about where they live, whether it's Madison or wherever it may be, and they're thinking about what it means to live in a community where you've got to see people face-to-face, you've got to deal with them, you can't just flame them and torch them without penalty the way you might on social media. You've got to rehumanize the way that you argue with them and the way that you deal with them. And a bad argument is one where we just give up on the idea of humanization.
We are talking about what makes, we're talking about arguing and how arguing can bring us forward in this country and in our lives. I also want to reiterate, Eric Liu, the idea of listening. I think that it is a lost art, and most people don't realize how important it is. When you see people on TV, when you see people on stage, they are mostly listening to each other, not necessarily talking to each other. We have a lot of calls coming in here. I want to go to Greg from La Crosse. Greg, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Eric, after the election and after some of the grieving was took place, I decided I wanted to try to talk to people more, and I turned to my dad. We differ in a lot of ways. He's kind of a golden rule guy, a very subjective approach, and I had tried to talk with him some, and he just basically said, no, you know, I don't want to, we don't need to, there's no point. And I'm wondering what advice you might have for people like myself who do like to argue, understanding the different forms of argument, understanding that listening is important as well. Where might I be able to start off, again, approaching him? We have a good relationship. I just wanted to try to open the conversation more with him, and I think if I can do that, I can do a better job with other people as well.
Thank you for that, Greg. Isn't the golden rule, though, treat others as you would have them treat you?
Yeah, and I think it's subjective, because what I want is what I'll do to others, and if my dad doesn't want to talk, then he's not going to talk to other people either.
Thank you for that, Greg. Eric?
Well, I think, first of all, I just appreciate Greg sharing that. I think there are a lot of folks and a lot of families, again, particularly in this time right now, that where everybody's emotions, at least about politics, are heightened, where, you know, that they're experiencing something like that, where one person may want to engage and argue, and the other is just like, not going there. I don't even want to, you know, deal with that. And I think the counsel that I would offer is, in the first place, to not begin with the idea that, hey, I'd like to discuss issues with you or discuss, you know, something contentious with you, but really just begin a conversation that is all about questions. And the questions that you want to pose are questions that, again, are about how is your worldview formed? How did you come to see the world the way you do? What experiences in your life? What positive experiences? What traumatic experiences? What great teachers and mentors? What tormentors or negative figures in your life? You know, asking questions like that draw out another person's story. Now, in this case, between a father and son, they may already know a lot about these stories of each other. And yet still, again, if we are genuinely curious, there's always more to ask in a way that is, that number one, draws the other person out. But number two, again, establishes this foundation of, okay, now we've talked about how, you know, this particular experience shaped you, or how this recent, you know, election debate, you know, made you decide that there's no point in engaging here. But we've kind of talked that first layer out a little bit. And that makes possible then, you know, a reciprocal notion of, hey, well, let me tell you how, you know, I see the world, and explain, you know, where I'm coming from. And it doesn't even have to result in a quote-unquote debate. It just has to be a process of rehumanizing and recognizing where the other person is coming from, and that they have a certain measure of humanity and dignity. And look, you know, I can anticipate some caller saying, what about if that other person that you're trying to do that with is someone who literally does not acknowledge your humanity or your dignity? You know, someone who has a you know, if you're an immigrant, and this is somebody who is completely nativist and thinks immigrants are the bane of America's existence, if you're a person of color and this person essentially is a white supremacist, how can you even be the one to acknowledge their humanity when they won't acknowledge yours? And you know, what I would say quickly to that is to remember that even during the depths of Jim Crow in this country, you know, civil rights leaders, activists, people like Thurgood Marshall, the great lawyer who ultimately became a Supreme Court justice, but back in the 40s and 50s was working up and down the South, bringing cases on behalf of the NAACP. And when you read Justice Marshall's papers, you realize everywhere he went in the South, where he was encountering people who literally dehumanized him, who did not recognize him as human, he was building friendships, even with these people he was on the other side of. And he was listening to them. He was trying to understand them. He did not himself get exercised by them. He knew who he was. He was centered in his own sense of identity. And he was not naive. He understood the danger he was in. But he also understood that there was only one way to set in motion a positive feedback loop of increasing humanity, and that was for him to model it.
We are talking with Eric Liu about better ways to argue and the need for argument in our society. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us. We love tweets at WPR Mornings. Adam from Milwaukee wants to join the conversation. Welcome, Adam.
Hi, good morning. The comment about asking questions is a good segue for what I was going to bring up on air here. And that is, I think I'm like a lot of people. I don't want to argue. I don't want to be a professional debater. But I still want to have these important and critical conversations with people. So I was a bit frustrated that I didn't know how to do this. But I stumbled upon some YouTube videos where they're using this conversational approach of asking, like, Socratic questions to have a cordial conversation about what people believe and why they believe it. And so I just wanted to mention that. It's called street epistemology, and maybe your guest has even heard of it. There's a lot of examples on YouTube, and it's, like I said, it's not a debate at all. It's about getting at what someone believes, how they came to believe it by asking questions and coming to a greater mutual understanding of the topic at hand.
Asking questions, Eric. Thank you very much for that, Adam. Asking questions.
Yeah, I think Adam is really onto something, and it's not only about asking questions, but he talks about this, you know, the Socratic spirit. It is again, asking questions that can draw out, the truth from that person's angle and perspective, and asking creates such a different energy from asserting, right? And when you think about the what makes a better argument? You've asked me, Carrie, what makes a bad argument?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our project, the Better Arguments Project, we've been conducting focus groups, for lack of a better word, all around the United States with young people, with older people, with people who are very experienced in politics and those who are not. And we're preparing to go deep in several communities across the United States to spend a deep conversation with people about how in their locality, just rooted in community, what the culture of argumentation or the culture of engagement looks like and feels like there. And you know, Anchorage, Alaska, Dumas, Arkansas, Queens, New York, three very different places. But across all of these different kinds of conversations, we've learned four or five kind of core rules about what makes a better argument. One we've talked a little bit about, but I just want to name it, and that is take winning off the table, right? And I cannot emphasize how important this is. If you are listening in order to win, if you are engaging somebody to win, you're going to get a dynamic in which the other side does not want to let you win, and they will use every tactic in the book, and they will refuse to acknowledge what they in their own hearts may know to be reality because they don't want to lose. But if you take winning off the table and replace it with understanding, hey, I want to engage you in this conversation. I want to ask you questions. Maybe I would even want to engage you in a debate, but not to win, just to understand where you're coming from. That's number one. I think a second thing that both Adam really speaks to and what the previous caller, Greg, really named was the idea of prioritizing relationships and listening passionately, like remembering that this is about human relationships, and you got to put those at the center and honor those relationships and the history of them. I think a third major tenet for a better argument is pay attention to context, right? The cultural context, the political context, the regional context. What will work, as a better argument, in a Chinese-American family like the one I grew up in, might be different from what will work in a Scandinavian American family, like so many in the upper Midwest and in Wisconsin. You know, a different vibe, a different style. The Queens argument is going to be very different from the Dumas, Arkansas argument. So pay attention to context. The fourth rule is this: embrace vulnerability. And again, both your callers already this morning have modeled that in ways that I think are super admirable. You know, acknowledge your own fear, acknowledge your own pain, acknowledge the things that you're scared of doing or wading into, and that helps model it for the other side. And then the most important one, the fifth and final rule of a better argument, is that you've got to be willing to have your own mind be changed. It is impossible to change another person's mind if you're not willing to have your own mind changed. And yet, think about all the ways in which all the time we get into political and civic debates quite certain of our worldview, and the only objective is to move the other guy over to our side. You've got to have some willingness to shift because otherwise the other party will smell that you don't and won't yield an inch for her part.
We are talking about arguing in our society. Eric Liu very much thinks that it will make things better if we learn how to argue and learn how to argue well, as he just talked about. We're also taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Email us. We've got a few emails coming in at ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Right now, we've got Karen from Spooner. Welcome to the program, Karen.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you so much for having this program. It's really marvelous. One of the things I think that people have to recognize is that they have to talk so people will listen. Hmm. So when you're trying to not just argue, but perhaps change minds, you have to listen in such a way that you understand the vocabulary of the person you're speaking with. There's a book called, an old book called, The Gentle Art of Verbal Self-Defense, which, you know, is really a marvelous book because it talks about that there is also a difference in arguing between people who have an up status and people who have a down status.
Ah.
By and large, when women argue with men, for instance, we have to, and this is more so than it was in the past, understand sports terminology. We have to look at things differently, or they're not going to listen to what we have to say because we may use words that aren't in their cultural vocabulary.
So, Karen, thank you for that. That's an excellent point that sometimes we come from different cultures, and we may use a word that shows our vulnerability, but the culture or the person we're talking to might see that as a weakness,
yeah,
and might want to explore that, exploit that. So, talk to that, Eric.
Well, I think, again, Karen, I so appreciate what you're pointing out here, and not only in the first place, it's just your use of the idea of vocabulary, right?
Mm-hmm.
The idea that people from different backgrounds, I'm not talking cultures necessarily like ethnic cultures, but even urban versus rural,
mm-hmm,
right? I mean, a pure Wisconsin issue, the way people are going to talk about life and
Husband versus wife, to be perfectly honest.
Well, exactly. You know, and I think the other thing that Karen really put her finger on, which when I said jokingly at the beginning that we don't need fewer arguments in American political life, we just need less stupid ones, I said less stupid means more historically literate and more emotionally literate. But the third prong of a less stupid argument is exactly what Karen is talking about, which is arguments that are honest about power differentials, honest about the fact that, hey, we're coming into this argument from a different, as she puts it, status standpoint. And one of the best things you can do is actually to name that, just name that fact. Like, if I'm having an argument as a civilian with a police officer, there's inherently a power differential there, right? This other person's got a gun and a badge,
mm-hmm,
and I may be a citizen who theoretically pays this person's salary, but in that moment, we're not quite on equal footing. And so naming that in the first place is a way to, if not neutralize it, at least make both parties conscious of the fact that, hey, we've got to focus on the substance of what we're trying to say here and not just the fact that this is one game where a, you know, high power individual can stomp a lower power individual. And I want to go deeper, perhaps as other callers join in, to the other dimension of what Karen's talking about, which is the gender dynamic and the gender dimension of both power and arguments around politics, because I think, again, you don't have to look at the 2016 presidential election. Just look at everyday life and the ways in which our culture still gives a default setting to men in public arguments and gives men often the last word. And I think there's a whole lot of habits that both men and women have to unlearn in order for us to have better arguments.
We will look into those habits of gender and how to have better arguments when we come back. We are talking to Eric Liu, and we are taking your calls about how to have a better argument. 800-642-1234 or ideas@WPR.org is our email. We'll be back in a moment. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. How do we argue constructively? This is the question of our time, and it is the question that Eric Liu tackles with his A Better Arguments project out of the Aspen Institute. We are taking your calls on this, 800-642-1234. You can also email us, as many people are doing this morning, at ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. What happens when you hear something that you don't quite agree with? Are you the kind of person who says, oh, that's not quite true? Or do you just kind of walk away? We are talking about better arguments. And we have Star from Arkdale. Welcome to the program, Star.
Well, thank you. I've been enjoying this and I'm absorbing a lot. My comment is that you're talking about asking questions, and I've always taught my kids when they were little up, don't ask the question unless you can handle the answer.
Ah. So, Eric Liu, thank you. That's actually a really great piece of advice. But, Eric Liu, what do you think of this?
Well, I love that, and there's a lot of ways to interpret handling the answer. But it goes back to that fifth rule that I was describing earlier in the conversation of what makes a better argument, and that is, you've got to be willing on some level to have your own mind be changed, right? What makes a better argument is if you are willing to be transformed yourself. And so, if an answer to your question is going to challenge you, is going to blow your mind, is going to disturb you, is going to shake, you know, what you thought were unshakable truths, then actually that's a good thing. It doesn't mean you have to be in the moment totally able to process it, but if it shakes you, that's a potentially good thing, but because it means you're in a moment and in a space where you're transformable and your own mind can be changed. And again, I acknowledge that in many arguments, or at least, you know, debates, the other side will see that in you and they'll think, oh, a moment of weakness, I can pounce and exploit, as you were saying earlier, Carrie. And again, this raises just a meta question that we all have to face right now, because we're in a vicious cycle downward right now in our American national culture of argumentation. And it's a vicious cycle that just says, well, if this other person's going to behave like they would on Twitter or social media or Facebook and just blast at me anonymously and, you know, without any consequence or humanity, then I guess I got to do the same thing, right? And at some point, some of us have to be the ones essentially to choose to be adult and choose to say, you know what, I'm going to break that cycle. There's only one way to break that cycle, and that is to be the one who, again, embraces vulnerability, who says that, hey, what you've just said actually really kind of blew my mind, and I'm not quite sure I'm so sure of myself anymore. And for some people, they'll just think you're weak. But for other people, that will be arresting in itself, and they will think, wow, this person's actually willing to change and be engaged. Now I'm going to shift my posture, and we're going to have a different kind of discussion. And maybe I myself should be willing to change and open up. And I think at every scale of human encounter, whether it's between spouses or among, you know, people in a congregation or among strangers debating politics, if you can lead with that willingness to change, oftentimes the other person will be able to reciprocate. But even if they're not, at a minimum, you've tried to set off a new positive contagion instead of the negative one that is.
Right. I was just going to say that sometimes when people lead with that willingness to change, the person on the other side says, ha, that's a weakness. I can win now. And they try and go in for the kill. And what do you do when that happens?
I think if you have really internalized rule number one that I said for a better argument, which is take winning off the table, then that's just another thing that you can detach from when that other person pounces and says, aha, I got you. You can just say without undue emotion, that's interesting that you think you can pounce and that you think you're winning here. I want to understand more. Like, why do you think that's a weakness, what I just said? Why do you think that what I said, you know, absolves you of the weaknesses of your own argument? Just, again, persist in trying to understand. This takes practice, by the way. I'm not saying that this is something that overnight any of us can do instantly. And, you know, for listeners who are, you know, may not have a pen and paper handy as I've been listing these five Rules for a Better Argument. If you just go to the website that we've set up for the Better Arguments Project, and the website is simply betterarguments.org, you can see documents that we've laid out and simple guides for laying out these principles of a better argument and giving you some suggestions for everybody. I mean, the thing is that this isn't just for people who are, again, who eat and breathe politics every day and want to argue about the ins and outs of what's going on in Congress. This is for all of us at every dimension of our lives, and these are habits, again, that have fallen into disuse in American life, and what we've got to do, starting with, you know, young people, but people of every age, is just to start practicing again.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that you wanted to dig a little deeper into gender. I'm going to allow you a couple minutes to do that right now. How does gender shape the arguments we have?
Well, I think it was Karen, who the previous caller, who was describing the way in which gender can often be an aspect of both how people will have different vocabularies, as she put it, different ways of expressing a point. And she said, you know, men might use sports metaphors or war metaphors, and women might use a different set of metaphors. But the other aspect of gender that's important is that in so many social and political or economic situations, gender correlates with a power imbalance. And so, you know, you walk into a lot of settings in public life where the default setting is male, where the people in charge are men, where the voice of authority is presumed to be male. Again, one of the things that is important to do is to disarm that and to just to name that fact, even as you walk into a room, not to put the men in the room on the defensive, but just to say, hey, this is something I want to acknowledge here, and I really invite you to listen to what I'm saying, even though my voice as a woman is not the usual dominant voice that you might hear in this space, in this room. Ideally, frankly, it's not even the woman who has to say that. It can be one of the men in the room. You know, I think that's a responsibility that men across the board, I mean, we're not just talking about political arguments now in the age of, rising gender equality. Men have to be the ones to say, hey, I want to take the lead here and recognize in this room that we are 80% men and only 20% women or whatever. And I want to make sure that we're making this feel as welcoming an environment as possible for the women in this room to have their voice be expressed as authentically as they want to express it. If you say that as a man, you change the dynamic in the room, right? And I think that's that's part of what it means when I talk about pay attention to context. We're not just having arguments and debates in a vacuum. We're not doing some philosophical exercise that is detached from the context of place and relationship and power dynamics. So let's see those things and let's name those things as a way to help transcend those things.
So one of the things you just brought up is workplace issues. We actually have had an emailer, Jamie from Green Bay, email to ask, how do you handle politics in the workplace? How do you argue or maybe avoid argument in the workplace?
Well, I think the workplace is in some ways no different from any other environment where people are going to have an instinct to avert and avoid conflict, right? I mean, you think about a faith community where people may differ on a political issue, but they don't want to go there because it may seem disruptive or it may seem dangerous to open up a potential division like that. In both these settings, whether it's a workplace or some other community where people have prior relationships and need to sustain some baseline of working relationship, the thing to do is to begin with relationship and to begin with the fact, not with the debate points about the thing you're arguing, whether it's, healthcare or immigration or, funding for higher education in the state of Wisconsin, whatever it might be. But actually to say, let's start with the foundation of how you and I know each other. We've worked together for so many years. We've done stuff together. We've solved problems together. We've had really tough experiences together. We've navigated things and we've learned a lot from each other about each other, and beginning with that then gives you a different kind of opening to say, okay, so knowing you the way I know you, I'm really curious, Carrie, like, we've worked together for years, and I've always noticed that, you know, you like to button things up really neatly and kind of, you know, come to a conclusion quickly. Where did that come from? Is that your nature, or did you feel like there was somebody in your life, a parent or a teacher, who really made you that way, right? And then that person is invited to reflect on herself. You're invited to ask, huh, how did I come to be that way, right? And it is a bit like what one of your earlier callers was saying about this, what Adam was saying about the Socratic spirit of asking, asking to understand and draw things out, but in a way that, that leads the conversation somewhere, right? If you reflect on how you came to your nature to really have things kind of neat and buttoned up in a certain way, that opens up a different way to say, yeah, you know, it's funny because I was raised to always, you know, recognize, you know, that everything is shades of gray, nothing's black and white, and maybe that's why we're seeing things differently on this, but, you know, imagine being me, or let me try to imagine being you, and having to have things really clear and crisp, and again, that kind of conversation is actually harder to have with a stranger than it is with somebody you've actually spent time with, you know, in the same office or the same, hallway or whatever. And so I would take advantage of the fact that there is a prior foundation of relationship in the workplace. And it doesn't have to be scary to go there if you begin with humanization.
We are talking about better arguments with Eric Liu. We have a lot of calls. Thomas from Milwaukee, welcome to the program.
Hi. This has been an interesting hour and a bit shocking, really. First of all, I would advise people in office settings not to go into meetings and start talking about gender imbalances and prejudging them based on the fact that they're female and there's only, you know, three other people and you assume that they're not capable of doing whatever, even if it comes from a place of benevolence. You're going to get in a lot of trouble with HR if you start doing that business, so that's number one. But number two, I think, and I'm trying to be as respectful as possible here, but this is contributing to the problem because at no point here have you talked about facts and evidence. Now, we have like 300 years of Western civilization based on logic and reason, and our entire judicial system is built around getting rid of people's biases and the emotions and everything they bring to a controversy and focusing on what we know. And I'm a little surprised that that hasn't even come up. Instead, we want to talk about what perspective do you have, what are your emotions, how do you feel. Those are all things that get in the way of finding agreement on things. Do you give any consideration to the idea that we should focus on facts and evidence?
Thank you for that, Thomas. I'm interested, Eric, in his naming the judicial system, which isn't always fair to everybody based on facts and evidence. Talk to me about this.
Well, I think Thomas raises a really important point. I'm glad he brought it up. But facts and evidence are foundational, and you know, at a certain point in an argument, you know, you can't argue that up is down and down is up. So I quite agree that at a certain point in an argument, you have to go there. Where I would differ is with the idea that you should start there. Again, this is not about, I'm as committed to the Western tradition of, you know, reason and the Enlightenment tradition of trying to solve things through reason as anybody else. But I'm also a student of human nature. And, you know, human nature tells us, and indeed, if that's not satisfactory to you, psychology tells us. There's actually a great article in the July issue of Scientific American by a set of psychologists about the ways in which, because all humans are wired for cognitive bias, to seek out evidence and facts that confirm their prior bias, so, you know, what's called confirmation bias, it's a very dangerous thing. The mere presence of facts and evidence doesn't mean you're going to have some platonic ideal of a neutral argument that is detached from emotion. It just means that people are motivated to sift through and find only the facts and evidence that support their prior worldview, right? And what these psychologists have found is that if in leading such a debate or an argument, you try to explicitly tell the participants to focus on facts and evidence, it actually makes things worse. experimental psychologists will tell you they actually double down on their selectivity in confirming their own prior biases. And so what we've got to do actually is not only, to Thomas's fair point, not only appeal to emotions and empathy and understanding, but actually practice the hard skill of devil's advocacy. You know, really step into the other side's worldview and try to make the best argument you can using facts and evidence as well as emotional intelligence that they would make. And that turns out to be one of the only effective ways to bust through this tendency for confirmation bias that can obliterate the usefulness of facts and evidence. And that is if you have to be stepping into the other side's shoes. And I want to mention just, you know, in our final minutes here, one of our deep partners in the Better Arguments Project is an organization called Facing History and Ourselves. They're a great education nonprofit based in Boston, working all across the United States. And they began 40-some years ago as a Holocaust education organization. But what they expanded into over the years, teaching young people, was not so much only about the Holocaust, but about moral choice making. How do you make hard moral choices during situations not only like Germany in the 1930s, but the American South in the 1950s, or apartheid South Africa, right? And what they focus on so much is that all of these questions that are big questions about debate and American culture and about American politics boil down to simple choices that we each make to humanize or dehumanize, to engage or disengage.
Eric, I'm going to have to stop you there. We have been talking to Eric Liu, who is trying to make us argue better so that we understand each other. He is head of the Better Arguments Project at the Aspen Institute. Thanks for being with us, Eric.